Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news, starting with the debt ceiling deal. Christopher Jennings, who was senior healthcare advisor in the Clinton White House and is now director of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Health Reform Project, joins us. He will assess what kind of hit healthcare will take in the cuts-only deal that ended the economic hostage crisis, at least in the short term. Then Michael Tomasky joins us. He is special correspondent for Newsweek and the Daily Beast, and we will talk about strategy, or the lack thereof, in the White House that allowed a minority of Tea Party zealots to shape national policy, stall economic recovery, and impoverish millions of Americans. Then we will look into the part that was left out of the deal, that is, jobs and unemployment. Judith Conte with the National Employment Law Project joins us to discuss the likelihood of increasing joblessness and unemployment that will result from this deal and what impact that will have on next year's elections. Then finally, we turn to Syria, a country that is bleeding as the Assad regime turns its tanks and artillery on its defenseless citizens. Dr. Muruf Juhijati, Professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University, joins us to discuss the Obama administration's lack of response to the regime's outrages that will become even more brazen and brutal in the months of Ramadan ahead. Joining us now is Christopher Jennings, who is the president of healthcare consulting firm Jennings Policy Strategies and is co-staff director of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Health Reform Project. From 1994 to 2001, Christopher Jennings served in the Clinton White House as senior healthcare advisor at the Domestic Policy and National Economic Councils. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christopher Jennings.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Ian. Thank you for having me.
And Christopher, the hit that healthcare is going to take, can you walk us through the deal that's made as much as we know about it? And it still hasn't been ratified, although by the Congress, but I assume that it will be. Is that a safe assumption?
Yes, I think it's now the only question really was the House vote. The Senate is clearly going to vote this and pass this through, and the President will be signing it into law very, very shortly. So that is not into question. In terms of your question about health care, I guess there's what we know and there's what we don't know. What we do know is that there will be some substantial cuts to Medicare on the provider side almost inevitably at some point in time, probably not as big as would be included in a major deal with Republicans if there's a negotiation. And as you know, as part of this agreement, we did provide the authority for the president to raise the debt and to provide resources to make sure we pay off our past expenses. But in November, there will be specific recommendations that will be due from the so-called super congressional committee that will be eligible for an up and down vote right before Christmas. That negotiated deal could be a much, much bigger cut than the $1.2 trillion additional cut that could happen across the board should they fail to reach agreement.
Well, just to backtrack a little bit on the House vote, the House vote, in fact, did vote. They did pass at 161 against. And Representative Giffords, who was, of course, almost fatally wounded, appeared for this vote for the first time to vote for it. So the debt ceiling bill has passed, and it's now
passed the House, and then it'll pass the Senate.
Right. Shortly. Yeah, just to let our audience know that we're trying to be on top of this. So tell us, though, about this mechanism, this super Congress, because my understanding is that it's not something that the president's happy with. It's 12, 6 from the House, 6 from the Senate, I believe, evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats. They basically deliberate on making cuts. Then there's no ability to filibuster or alter. It's an up or down vote. If their recommendations don't get voted on, then the Congress has a year before the automatic trigger comes into effect. And a lot of people are already saying, wait a minute, that's going to be the year where the health care lobbyists and the defense lobbyists pile on.
Well, yeah, you've raised a lot of questions. Well, first, in he doesn't like the super committee, perhaps because it is a congressionally appointed committee. And, of course, the House and Senate Republicans are already signaling that they're not going to put revenues on the table. And indeed, that is the case. And we could be in the same negotiating environment that we just saw, where we're just negotiating more and more cuts from programs that people really care about and make a difference in real people's lives, particularly in health care, including Medicare and Medicaid and a host of other programs. And seeing the same or worse outcome that we just saw in this particular agreement. And then, of course, as you say, if they get an agreement, it's an up or down vote. If it passes the House and Senate, the president has no option other than to sign or to veto the legislation. If they don't pass the legislation or it doesn't become law, then the automatic sequester goes into effect. It becomes the law, but the cuts don't take place until 2013. And that's probably an area where, there's no question, Medicare would be automatically, specifically providers of Medicare would be specifically targeted with significant cuts.
And apparently significant cuts to defense as well.
Which
is why I don't think it's going to happen, right?
Well, I mean, it's pick your poison here, because you can go back and in the next following year, in 2012, an election year, try to lobby back those cuts. But that, it's a technical issue, but since that sequester becomes law if the bipartisan agreement does not get achieved, then to repeal those cuts, you actually have to find new ways to pay for them, and that becomes very difficult in this Congress as well. So it's designed in a way to create a dynamic for this bipartisan commission to come together. But I would tell you, I think right now, as I look at it, from a perspective of progressives, some people might prefer the sequester over some sort of unknown agreement with the Republicans in Congress.
Well, this is the Republican Congress that just was rewarded for hostage taking, right? The economic hostage crisis, which
exactly.
They totally manufactured, and they've been rewarded. I mean, as a nation, we do not negotiate with terrorists, but...
Well, except this time.
Well, what about next time? I mean...
it's a problem. In fact, Senator McConnell said this very day, said from now on, every single debt limit extension from any president going forward will require a negotiated agreement with Congress to provide for dollar-for-dollar cuts in the budget. And the implications of that are staggering.
Well, it might, just to get our minds around this, because it always astounds me, Chris Jennings, the usurpation of power on the part of the Republicans, but it seems to work. This is the same minority Republicans in the Senate who have said that a majority vote doesn't count anymore, 51%. It has to be a supermajority of 60% past the filibuster before anything gets considered. So, again, we have this bizarre ability on the part of a minority to set the agenda. I mean, you were
right.
You worked in the Clinton White House, right? And
yes.
So you lived through
this
whole thing with Newt Gingrich, right?
And we had a Republican Congress that we had to deal with, and I think arguably President Clinton was a master at negotiating, not just from a policy perspective, but also from a political perspective. I think he successfully showed the public that there's a right way and a wrong way to reduce the deficit, and he took his message to the public. And I think the public largely agreed with him, and he was willing to go to the line and to even to the point where we had to shut down the government. And I think that this president, our president, needs to do a little bit more of that, in particular needs to get out and sell the vision that I think we all agree with, but that he has not been successful in communicating.
Well, but this is not the first time the president's taken a hit that he said he wouldn't take. You go back to the negotiation over the extension of unemployment benefits in exchange for extending the Bush tax cuts. That, by any measure, wasn't a great victory. And in that negotiation, he failed to see this freight train coming at him, which was the Republican Tea Party caucus saying that they wouldn't raise the debt ceiling. Now, I recall that months ago when that came up, the Liberals were basically joking about the Tea Party crazies. They're going to have an education when reality, the rubber meets the road. Well, look what happened. We're the ones getting an education, not the.
You're right.
You're right.
And I also think, and the both the president and the Democrats in Congress who controlled the Congress before 2010. Really, in retrospect, should have addressed the tax cut and reform issue earlier, when they were in a much better position to do that. And then afterwards, I think people are going to debate whether he did well or not in that negotiation. But he definitely was negotiating in a more in a weaker state post the 2010 election. And there's been many errors along the way in terms of timing and strategy and communication. Although, in fairness to him, he's negotiating with people who, in some cases, would be willing to see the government default on its debts. And it's just an extraordinary situation. It's something that did not exist in the 1990s when I served and privileged to serve President Clinton. And now we see a whole new dynamic here.
Well, but in many ways, the reason that the 14th Amendment, Section 4 of the 14th Amendment says that the national debt can't be used as a political hostage was because in the post-Civil War period there was a concern that maybe the Democrats, the Southern Dixiecrats, would take over the Congress and renege on the South's debts. So they put that in the Constitution. So I don't know why the hell the president didn't.
I think that's
exactly what just happened, though.
My old boss, President Clinton, had indicated a while ago that he would think about using that authority. And in any event, one could argue that to publicly say that you aren't going to use it could undermine your leverage to negotiate something better in the Congress. And so there are different levels of how one negotiates, and I think there are people who feel that certainly the president, both in terms of substantive policy, in terms of strategic position, in terms of negotiation, in terms of communication, has fallen short, Vice President Biden today, meeting with the Democrats in the Senate today, at least the reports suggest that he acknowledges that they have learned things and things will be better going forward, and certainly we hope so. But I do, and I really welcome, and I hope we can pivot to, and this may be one of your next segments, which is that we do have to pivot to the jobs and economic debate and agenda, because if we don't find a way to alter the growth in our economy and specifically job growth, we're at real peril of having a one-term presidency.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Christopher Jennings.
All right, it's my pleasure, Ian. Good talking to you.
Likewise. I've been speaking with Christopher Jennings, who is the president of the healthcare consulting firm Jennings Policy Strategies and is co-staff director of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Health Reform Project from 1994 to 2001. Christopher Jennings served in the Clinton White House as senior healthcare advisor at the Domestic Policy and National Economic Councils. Now let's turn to another analysis of the debt ceiling deal. Joining us now is Michael Tomasky, who is special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast and editor of Democracy, a Journal of Ideas. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Tomasky.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be with you.
And in the introduction to the program, I suggested here that we're going to talk to you about strategy or the lack thereof in the White House that allowed a minority of Tea Party zealots to shape national policy, stall economic recovery, and impoverish millions of Americans. Is that hyperbole on my part?
No. I second the motion, sir.
Well, how did this happen?
Well, as you suggest, I think there are many and complicated reasons why the White House isn't very good at this, and I think those reasons begin with the fact that the president just has a sort of philosophical distaste for hardball. But we could go into that in detail if you want. But what it amounts to is that there were, as you suggested, as you were introducing me, several opportunities for Obama and this White House to map out a different strategy that I think would have resulted in a very different conclusion here. I'll just start with one and then yield the floor back to you. But this really goes back to last December when he agreed to extend all the Bush tax cuts for all income brackets. There were people writing back in December and saying, arguing, pundits, commentators, policy specialists, and so forth, who were saying, at that time, last December, he should make the Republicans accept a clean debt bill in exchange for extending the Bush tax cuts, because people saw this coming. Well, if these people saw this coming, why didn't the White House see it coming?
Well, it at that time, by the way, I understand that Schumer had made a deal that the Republicans thought was okay. That is, that to extend the cuts, but not for the people earning above $2 million?
Above $1 million.
Was it above $1 million, was it?
I think that's right. And the White House wouldn't go for that either. And there's no reason that this $250,000 number is set in stone. I mean, it's only been the number since the Bush administration. It doesn't have to be the number.
Right.
There are a lot of different ways to do this sort of thing. But, I share your frustration with their lack of strategic sense. And then just another example that has been boggling my mind the last couple of days is this whole 14th Amendment business. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with the basic contours of that. Well, Obama himself and Jay Carney, his press person, both said in recent weeks that they felt that this 14th Amendment option and raising the debt ceiling unilaterally was not viable and not something that they could do. Okay, fine, but actually not fine, but hypothetically fine. But even if you don't think that that's something that you can do, why say that?
Why take it off the table? Yeah.
Why? You've got to. It's negotiating 101. Make the other guy think you might do it. I mean, what was that? Unbelievable.
Well, President Clinton even suggested they invoke it. And let's face it, Michael Tomasky, it was put in the Constitution after the Civil War because there was a concern that the Dixiecrats could take over the Democratic Party and renege on the South's debts. And they put it in the Constitution that you cannot mess with the debt ceiling for political reasons.
The similarities between that situation and this one are eerie and freaky if you really dig into them. You're quite right.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Tomasky, who is special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast and editor of Democracy, a Journal of Ideas. And one of the good friends of the White House, Andy Stern, I think he maybe was responsible for $75, $80 million in in 2008 in their coffers. I don't quite know the figures, but I know he helped elect President Obama, I think, by no means. He says, quoting him, "We have now had at least three or more experiences of the president explaining to people that he has a plan and it's under control, but the results don't match. He has an unreasonable Congress that doesn't respond to reason, so why continue to reason with them?" Seems like a reasonable thing to say.
Well, you know, I wrote a column a couple of weeks ago. I think, if I may say so, it was a pretty good one, too. It was called The Untransformational President, if people want to Google it. But, you know, he always feels that he needs to be the reasonable person. And, you know, this phrase that they repeat over and over again, these White House people, the adult in the room. But, you know, sometimes adults get mad, and sometimes adults go send kids into the corner, and sometimes adults read the Riot Act. And sometimes adults, you know, do other things besides sit there and speak calmly, like Mike Brady to the Brady kids. You know, that's not the only model of adult. That's probably lost on you, according to your accent.
No. We were victims of cultural imperialism. In Australia, we saw all the terrible American televisions, and. By the way, I know enough about this country. You know, I've been here long enough to become an American. There's an expression in America: "Nice guys finish last."
Yeah, that's right, a baseball expression, and you know, one that I think is coming into play here. I mean, there's no question that, you know, he got taken to the cleaners. Another expression by Mitch McConnell. You know, it is true. I'll have to say that, like, as I've looked over the details of the deal and certain things that are exempted, you know, Social Security and Medicaid and programs for the poor are exempted, I have felt less disgusted than I felt 36 hours ago. But that's as far as I'll go. I won't say better. I'll say less disgusted.
But Mitch McConnell, who you just mentioned, Michael Tomasky, he has now said that this is going to be their M.O., I mean, this is the man who said that his first priority is to make sure that President Obama is not reelected.
Oh, yeah.
He's the man who's been able to usurp power in the Senate by not allowing any majority of vote on anything, just about, arbitrarily setting the threshold to the filibuster-proof 60 margin. Yeah. Now he's saying that from now on, the Republic is going to tie the debt ceiling to revenue increases.
Yeah. Well, it's unbelievable. And as angry as I am at Obama for the way this turned out, obviously people should keep their ire trained on Mitch McConnell. This is the first time in the history of the United States that a Senate opposition has threatened to filibuster a debt ceiling vote. First time. And it's really pretty unconscionable, like way beyond the norms and practices of that body. And people should keep that in mind, absolutely. And as for looking forward, I was struck by a quote I saw the other day, yesterday. John Barrasso on Fox News, I wasn't watching, I hasten to point out, it was brought to my attention, this quote. He said, "We consider this round one of a 15-round fight." And that's exactly how the Republicans are thinking of this. This is a huge, long fight. They're just starting. You know, liberals think these are people on the left think these are draconian cuts. This is nothing to the people on the right. They think this is pennies. They think they've just begun. This is what people have to keep in mind. And you know, when I hear liberals trying to defend this deal, saying, well, you know, when the super committee reports out, well, you know, we might get some tax increases and we might get some revenues. I think, what movie have you been watching for the last 2 years?
Indeed, the opposite is obvious, that if which is likely, the super committee doesn't get the votes, then there's a year interregnum where before the trigger mandates the automatic cut, and that will be the year of the lobbyist.
Yeah, that's right. And there's another little hidden thing here, too, and I'm a little fuzzy on the details on this yet. I'm trying to report this tomorrow, so I'm just going to speak a little generally about it. But you know how October 1st is the new fiscal year every year in the United States. And we were, before this, looking at another big budget fight in September. Now, there is some sense that this bill that passed the House tonight and presumably is going to pass the Senate tomorrow obviates that September budget battle. But there are reasons to think that because of the way they can manipulate the rules, the Republicans can do things that will make the Democrats make more cuts in September, which just, you know, 7 weeks from now.
So just in the last minute or so then, Michael Tomasky, you don't think that that this is necessarily a wag the dog situation with the Tea Party wagging the Republican Party dog, that in fact this is really Republican policy and the Tea Party have just been kind of like the whip?
Yeah, that's right. I see them as much more unified. I think they're much more unified ideologically than some other people do. You know, the Republican Party has been a taxophobic party since Ronald Reagan, but especially since George Bush actually raised taxes in 1990. It's been, you know, since I think this is true. I'm dead certain this is true. Since George H.W. Bush agreed to a tax increase in 1990. I don't think there's been a single Republican vote for a tax increase.
But the truth of the matter isn't, and I'm not sure that truth matters anymore in the post-Karl Rove environment where the truth is a moving target and he who right. manages and manipulates and spins it the best wins the argument. But right. just for the sake of a little objective reality here, the United States is about, I think, 30th or something in terms of its taxing versus its GDP. Vis-a-vis its GDP, so it's way down, way below all the other the European social democracies and other democracies in terms of its tax burden. So when the president made that pitch that this is all about protecting the millionaires and the billionaires, clearly the shame game didn't work.
No, this is, shaming a Republican is like, I don't know what it's like trying to do. Good luck with that. They're not going to raise taxes on the top 2%. It's not going to happen.
But what about the American people? Apparently the polls indicate that they're not happy with the disparity of wealth and the basic unfairness of what's happening.
They're not happy at all. I mean, I'm sure you saw the poll, the most astounding poll I've seen in 10 years. Was the one where they asked the people, you know, how much wealth does the top 10% own, and how much wealth should it own, and people's estimations of what the two answers to that were would be considered incredibly left wing, would be considered Karl Marx. You know, you should look up this poll. It's just amazing, amazing results. But what do the people really? What influence can they have? They don't make. Thousands and thousands of dollars worth of campaign contributions.
Well, Michael Tomasky, I think...
bad situation.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Tomasky, who is special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast and editor of Democracy, a Journal of Ideas. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about unemployment and jobs, which is not a part of the debt ceiling deal.
Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Frustrated.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Judith Conte, who is the Federal Advocacy Coordinator for the National Employment Law Project. She's also the co-founder and former Executive Director of the DC Employment Justice Center. Welcome to Background Briefing, Judith Conte.
Thank you. I appreciate the invitation to be here tonight.
And Judith, the deal that was just struck, and the House voted yes, the Senate apparently will vote, the President will sign it, will avoid the shutdown. But it does feel as though hostage taking and ransom payment has worked. I mean, as a nation, we don't yield and don't bargain with terrorists, but on Capitol Hill, apparently.
It certainly does seem like a one-sided deal. You know, the president began these negotiations saying that he wouldn't sign anything that wasn't a balance between spending cuts and raising revenues, and this plan, this deal, doesn't raise a penny of revenue. So it is not the balanced plan that he called for, that's for sure.
But Judith, how is he going to run on this? Because it almost feels like a suicide pact. If you know that the economy is not recovering, the stimulus that you put out at the beginning of your administration, which a lot of people argue wasn't sufficient, which he negotiated with Chuck Grassley in the Senate to change 40% of it into tax breaks as opposed to cash, and then the Republicans turned around and not one of them voted for it, and now it's petered out, it's run out in the states. We see the distress in the states, laying off people. So we can see what's happening with the stimulus running out, and now this deal, which is likely to stall this anemic recovery dead in its tracks, is only going to create more joblessness and unemployment as he faces election in 2012. So it feels to me like he's playing into the Republicans' hands. If that's their intention, you know, do we have to be that cynical?
Well, you know, you would not be the only cynic to feel that way. Down here in D.C., there's certainly a lot of people that feel that way as well. You know, I think the president was between a rock and a hard place. He and his advisors felt that the possibility of default and what that could do to our economy was just too catastrophic and could well have put us back into a full-fledged recession. And they weren't willing to take that gamble, and some people on the other side of the aisle would. Not to be partisan about it, but, you know, the fact of the matter is that one party was willing to hold out, and at the end of the day, the leader of the country wasn't willing to take that risk. And I think that is a respectable position, but you are right. This was a time when there was an opportunity to not just reduce the deficit, not just deal with the debt ceiling, but to get some stimulus going, to perhaps do some job creation, you know, really have, again, done a balanced package. And there were opportunities to do all of that, and none of it happened other than cutting spending. So it is a moment of opportunity that is lost, and we are, as you all know, and as all your listeners know, mired with a Congress that really doesn't act terribly much unless there's a gun against its head. And there aren't many other guns that are available for the rest of the year. So, you know, this Congress still hasn't passed a single piece of job-creating legislation. There's no talk of it doing so. There's a few proposals out there. But there are very few opportunities left, and it's really quite unfortunate, because I think any economist would tell you that the single best way to not only fuel our economic recovery but to deal with our debt and deficit problems is to get people back to work and get them paying income taxes and get them paying sales taxes for the things that they buy with the money that they have. It's really quite simple, and it's really quite logical. And when we are dealing with a Congress that isn't going to do anything to create jobs, that's really stalling the recovery.
Again, I'm speaking with Judith Conte, who is the Federal Advocacy Coordinator for the National Employment Law Project. So in defense of when the president tried to shame the Republicans, suggesting that they only cared about millionaires and billionaires and corporate tax breaks, etc., the Republican response was that we can't tax the job creators. They substituted the word job creators for billionaires. Now, are the job creators going to step up?
Well, it's very interesting. My colleagues and I love that sleight of hand with employers now all of a sudden being called job creators, and with even millionaires and billionaires who don't create jobs and who aren't employers being called job creators. It's a wonderful piece of marketing. You know, we saw last month that there were 54,000 jobs created, which is nothing. If we have, 250,000 jobs created every single month, we'll get back to, out of the hole that we're in with jobs in 4 years. If we have 400,000 jobs a month, we'll get out of it in 3 years. The rate we're going right now, I don't know when we're ever going to see recovery. So it's all well and good to talk about how, at the end of last December, we forestalled the tax breaks because we forestalled reducing the Bush tax cuts because we needed this money to stimulate the economy, and millionaires and billionaires were going to use it to create jobs, and we've seen very anemic job growth ever since then. In the period, in at least in my lifetime, when we've seen the most robust job creation in the entirety of my life, it was during the years when President Clinton had raised taxes, cut spending in other areas, but really enacted some balanced, broad fiscal measures, including raising taxes on those who could afford to pay more, and job creation was booming. So, you do the math. We had the Bush tax cuts, and in the course of his entire administration, there was a net creation of less than 1 million jobs. There's been more, creation of more than 1 million jobs during the Obama administration already, and that's been in the aftermath of the recession. So it just doesn't seem to me that any facts and any reason bears out this notion that you cut taxes on millionaires and billionaires that magically jobs will be created. It just isn't happening. The job creators are asleep at the wheel.
And Economics 101 suggests that in a recession, in order to create demand and create revenues, is you create employment, and that creates demand. You just said that. So
exactly.
Nothing's happening.
When we saw the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act go into effect, before that we were in free fall, losing 400,000 or 500,000 jobs a month. All of a sudden, almost on a dime, that changed. And first you saw the job losses decrease very precipitously. Then all of a sudden you saw things even out. And then you slowly saw jobs starting to come back. Mm-hmm. And it was immediate after we infused that much cash into the American system. People had money to buy things. You spend things in the economy. That generates jobs.
Well, I thank you.
That's like 101 for that.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, Judith, but I'd like to revisit this conversation later. So I thank
Anytime,
you for joining
you know
us.
Where to find me.
Thank you so much.
And good evening to you and your listeners.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Judith Conte, who's the Federal Advocacy Coordinator for the National Employment Law Project. She's also the co-founder and former executive director of the D.C. Employment Justice Center. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about a country that is bleeding, Syria.
Down the pavement, looking for a job. I'll do anything except a stealing rock. Unemployment, something I can't do. If you can't use me, can you tell us some good news?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And the music you just heard is the anthem of the revolution in Syria, the lyrics going, Bashar, go leave. And in the end, what do you want? Everybody calls back freedom. Joining us now is Dr. Muraf Juhjati, who is a Syrian-born specialist on Middle East affairs, particularly Syrian politics. He is currently a professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. Muraf Juhjati has also served as the National Program Officer in Syria for the United Nations Development Program and as an advisor to the Syrian delegation to the Middle East peace talks. Welcome to Background Briefing, Muraf Juhjati.
Thank you for having me.
And, of course, it is incredibly brutal what is happening in Syria, in particular in the city of Hama, where the Syrian military is being turned on defense civilians, shelling and tank fire at point-blank range on people. The Syrian blogs are saying Syria is bleeding.
Syria is bleeding not only in Hama, although Hama got the core of the wrath of the Assad regime, but it has been widespread. Yesterday, for example, 146 people, unarmed civilians, have been killed by the Assad regime. You're right, by tank fire, by live ammunition. And so the ferocity is increasing.
So in the face of this, on Sunday, President Obama said he was appalled by the Syrian government's use of violence and brutality against its own people. A U.S. diplomat in Damascus told Al Jazeera this is full-on warfare on its own people. But surely this requires more than rhetoric from the Western powers, because this is what I don't really understand, Dr. Shuajadi. The Iranians have sent in their thugs, the Basij militia and the Revolutionary Guard Corps, who have practiced beating up their own people by suppressing the Green Revolution. They are being used by the Assad regime to beat up on the Syrian people, to murder them and to disappear them. All this is happening behind a wall of a media blackout because the Syrian regime doesn't allow any media in. So could you answer this simple question? If the United States has sanctions against Iran and Hezbollah, and they won't let the importation of refined petroleum, etc., why doesn't the United States have sanctions against the Syrian regime, who are employing Iran and Syria as thugs to beat up their own people?
That's a very good question. The oil production in Syria is around 390,000 barrels a day, which is to say that it's not very, very much, but it does contribute to over 30% of the revenue to the Syrian government. Were the U.S. to impose sanctions on Syrian oil exports or sanctions on oil transporters of Syrian oil, that would cripple the Assad regime and it would only hurry his downfall, something that is very, very needed by the civilian protesters in Syria who, for their freedom, are truly putting their lives in jeopardy. So the U.S. can impose these sanctions. They would have crippling effects on Syria, and they would have really very, very minimal, if any, effect on the oil market.
So, Dr. Shuajadi, you're in Washington, D.C. What is going on there? Or what's not? We know what's not going on there, which is they're not paying attention, or they don't want to do anything, or they don't think they can do anything, or they're afraid the collapse of the regime will end up with an Iraq-type sectarian situation. Whatever their reasoning is, I don't understand the lack of any action except to say that because this is not in the headlines, because the American people don't see what's happening there, they're therefore not riled up and they're not forcing their government to do something. So in the absence of any pressure, the United States is basically turning a blind eye.
It is absolutely outrageous. Here, the President of the United States and others always repeat to the rest of the world about American values of freedom and democracy, and even says to the people of the world who are demanding freedom that the United States is behind them. And here, on the other hand, we have truly a massacre going on in Syria, and what we are getting is rhetoric. I think Washington can and should do more to not only save Syrian civilians, but to bring the message to other dictators and dictatorships that America is true to its word and is true to its values.
Well, Dr. Shuajadi, I don't want you to misunderstand in any way that I'm being hawkish here or calling for military intervention, which is not the case. And I understand that the Obama administration doesn't want to get involved in any more land wars. They're bogged down in Iraq and in Afghanistan and to a lesser degree in Libya. But you're not calling for military intervention either, are you?
Let us make things more simple for the Obama administration. I am not calling for a military intervention, and the Syrian protesters have been adamant in saying they do not want any foreign military intervention. What they do want is the type of diplomatic intervention that is going to get the attention of the Assad regime. Now, in Washington, there may be nervousness as to what happens the day after Assad collapses, and they are imagining all sorts of chaos to take place in Syria. Actually, the fear of sectarian strife is an instrument of propaganda used by the Assad regime itself. The Assad regime is telling Syrians and the world that without Assad, there would be a civil war in Syria. This is absolutely not the case. The uprising in Syria is not sectarian. It is not ethnic. It is a national uprising against a dictatorship that has been in place for 48 years, and the Syrians want now to enjoy the fruits of freedom. No one is asking for military intervention.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Muraf Jujati, who's born in Syria and is now a professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. And in many ways, it's even more embarrassing to try and figure out the silence on the part of the U.S. administration or the lack of any kind of coherent policy or sanctions or condemnation, except beyond rhetoric. Right next door, the Turkish regime, who've always been very friendly to Syria, they've taken the lead. So I don't understand, again, what's going on in the White House and the State Department. Because right next door, the Turks, who are an important player in that region, they've clearly cut bait with the Assad family.
And so have the French, who are far ahead of Washington in terms of their dealings with Assad. They have declared him to be no longer legitimate. This is also the case of Britain. The Italians, who have been long friends of the Syrian government, have issued very strong condemnations. Even a country like India, which has to date not declared itself, has condemned the Syrian violence. Now, to be fair, Washington has issued a strong condemnation today. But again, these are words. And what is needed, and here I don't want to sound hawkish either, but what is needed are serious measures that will attract the attention of the Assad regime. What is at stake are the lives of unarmed civilians. Here you have a situation in which the Syrian security forces, along with the armed forces, are shelling civilian neighborhoods with tank fire. This is absolutely outrageous, and the international community should come together and in a very strong fashion not only condemn this regime, but indict Assad and friends to an international criminal court, because what is happening here are crimes against humanity.
But in terms of sanctions, and as I mentioned earlier, the United States has taken the lead on sanctions against Iran. Iran is supporting the Syrian regime by exporting its Basij militia thugs along with the Revolutionary Guard Corps. But more concretely, the Iranian regime has put up $5.6 billion of credit to keep the Assads in power. Meanwhile, we have sanctions against Iran for the importation of gasoline and diesel refined products. There again, we're applying it to Iran but not to Syria. If you applied those sanctions and if you went after the son-in-law, the family's bag man, who owns the oil concessions and has deals with UK Houston-based company, then you could basically shut them down, couldn't you?
Absolutely. This is what I was saying at the top of your show, that sanctions and an embargo against the export of Syrian oil.
And the importation of products, too. I mean, diesel and gasoline, the refined products have to come in, as far as I know.
These would cripple the Syrian economy without having any effect on the world market. And so this is an easy, simple, quick, legal way to contribute to the collapse of the Assad regime so that the Syrian citizenry can survive.
Now, again, without sounding hawkish, you're not trying to make life miserable for the Syrian people, although that will obviously be the consequences of these kind of sanctions. But clearly what they would do...
You mentioned the family members of Assad, the man to go after, of course, and he is the subject of sanctions himself, is a man by the name of Rami Makhlouf, who is the cousin of the president.
Sure.
And he and family have been, for the most part, pocketing revenues from oil exports. So if the Syrian oil exports are embargoed, it's not going to really affect Syrians themselves. It's going to affect the Assad family.
And presumably this would break the lock that the Assad clan have over the Syrian people, because they do have some support. They have support through their patronage system, but they also have support, I think, from some of the minorities who they are trying to essentially scare into supporting them by saying that if the Islamists take over, you, the Christians and Kurds, etc., will be the victims of a pogrom. So that's the strategy they have. And apparently, still within Damascus, there's some middle-class support for them. So I guess what I'm getting at here is, Dr. Shujaidi, would sanctions break the grip that the Syrian regime has over its supporters?
Absolutely. They are supported at one level by the business elite, but when the business elite sees that the source of instability in Syria, and instability is never good for business, when they see that it is the Assad regime, they will quit their support for Assad. The bureaucracy in Damascus, if there is an embargo against Syria of oil products again, the Assad regime will no longer be able to pay salaries, and so there goes the support of the bureaucracy. And in the end, it must be made very, very clear, not only to the international community, but also to Syrians and Syrian minorities, that the source of instability in Syria is the Assad regime, and its downfall does not translate into a civil war. On the contrary, Syria and Syrians are united against this dictatorial regime who is run as a family farm.
So the fact that we're having this conversation and coming up with this stuff that's by no means original, it should be obvious to everybody, particularly those in the diplomatic security world, it leads you to assume that there has to be a reason why none of this has been employed so far, and why the United States hasn't taken these steps and urged these steps. We know that the Russians and the Chinese are not necessarily supportive on the Security Council, but they haven't even been asked whether they'd support it or not. So something's going on here. There's some reason why we're having this conversation and the Obama administration is not. Or maybe they are, but they've decided not to do anything.
Well, here there are two things to be pointed out. One, I believe the Obama administration is fearful that the collapse of the Assad regime might have ripple effects, might have regional implications, in that there would be the export of strife to next-door Lebanon and to Iraq. Also that this may destabilize the Syrian-Israeli border. I don't think these fears are justified. Again, Syria has been a source of trouble, has been a source of instability in the Middle East, and the Middle East and the United States are better off without the Assad regime.
But you assume, like as I do, that there's got to be a reason, and that's the best you think? That's the main reason?
Well, there is potentially another reason, is that the Syrian opposition movement, which is, of course, very, very new. I mean, the uprising started only in March 15th, and the Syrian body politic, after 48 years of emergency laws, has not been able to organize politically. It may be that the Syrian opposition is still fragmented, so that if the Assad regime collapsed, there would be a period in the unknown, and what the United States probably fears is some sort of chaos in Syria as a result of the fragmentation of the Syrian opposition. But I got to tell you, in those 4.5 months, the Syrian opposition has gone a very long way in maturing and it's in trying to organize itself. If we get any video clips at all on YouTube and Facebook and so on as to what is happening on the ground, it is as a result of an opposition movement that has become technologically and media savvy. And so I do have a lot of hopes in the Syrian opposition that despite the fragmentation, that they will very soon provide a united front against the Assad family.
Well, obviously the Assad sent in the tanks just before Ramadan, and now that Ramadan has begun, this is going to be a month of strife, meaning that brave Syrians will face death in order to get rid of this family clan who think they have some divine right to rule this country forever. So just in closing then, can the opposition survive this month of repression, or do you think Ramadan will give them a opposition a boost and throughout the country?
I think Ramadan will give them a boost instead of protesting on Fridays, as has been the case until now. In Ramadan, every day is a Friday, and people congregate at the mosque after sunset. And so that is going to mean a lot more protests, far more frequently and far more intensely against the regime. I think the month of Ramadan is going to be quite a bloody month in Syria. My only fear is that there will be protester fatigue, and this is why I appeal to do more than issue statements of condemnation against the Assad regime in order to save lives.
I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Mourav Shuajati.
It's my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Mourav Shuajati, who's a Syrian-born specialist on Middle East affairs, particularly Syrian politics. He's currently a professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. He's also served as a National Program Officer in Syria for the United Nations Development Program and as advisor to the Syrian delegation to the Middle East peace talks. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with an analysis from somebody that worked in the Clinton administration who was director of their healthcare, he was their chief healthcare advisor during the Clinton White House. And of course, during the Clinton White House, there was a threat from Gingrich to shut down the government. And Clinton was able to call their bluff and win the round. And of course, a very different thing just happened with the Obama administration. So we got a sense of what's wrong with the Obama administration, but more of that later. But mostly I tried to focus with him on the consequences of this debt ceiling deal for healthcare and how much of a hit healthcare would take. And Chris Jennings, who was the director of the healthcare advisor, senior healthcare advisor to the Clinton White House, he walked us through the way that the Super Congress thing is set up and what is likely to happen with this committee of 12. And then if that wasn't voted, it was voted down their recommendations, then there's a year in which the lobbyists would go crazy to defending healthcare and defense before these mandatory cuts would take place. So in general, it was a pretty grim picture. But the guy that really weighed in was the next guy, Michael Tomasky, with Newsweek and the Daily Beast. He really agreed that this is ransom payments. This is terrorism. He can't understand how the Obama administration could have been so smoked. But they should have seen it coming. That back in December, they made that lousy deal to extend the Bush tax cuts. They could have, should have seen it coming then, because it was discussed that this is going to come up. And of course, all the liberals at the time laughed about, oh, the Tea Party are going to have a real education when they have to deal with the debt limit. Well, look what happened. The rest of us got an education. We talked with Judith Conte about the effects it will have on employment. She's with the National Employment Law Project. And then we talked about Syria at the end, a country that is bleeding. And again, the Obama administration does not seem to be paying attention to bringing down this regime that the people desperately in Syria desperately want to get rid of. And throughout the month of Ramadan, the Syrian government will be murdering many, many more of its people. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. and I'll be back again tomorrow with another background briefing. Bye for now.